Chapter 3. His eyes were starting to adapt. The dungeon's walls appeared as a rinsed-out grey, a tapestry that had been colonised and partially devoured by burrowing fishes. The tiny souls inhabiting the reef from which the walls had been grown were but dim flickers, but in their abundance generated a limpid glow that Lurien could perceive with something beyond sight. It was a gift resident in all Idoneth to some degree. Lurien had simply never needed to rely on it before now. Nor was it his only source of light. Magic lay over those structures as commonplace as sand or lime, deposited over tens of thousands of years, consumed by coral polyps, built into their exoskeletons and laid down layer by layer to imbue every crest and terrace with a crystalline shimmer. To swim through them produced a visual effect akin to turning an Ishratizar-made wine flute under a light globe. If the layered magic did not align perfectly with the soul light of the living coral, then it did conjure a profound sense of dimension, of depth. When he turned, it was as though he were the centre of a universe that turned with him. Lines of sight had little meaning to a sense rooted in intuition and magic. Lurien found that he could see through the reefs as easily as he could see the reefs themselves. He saw the tiny fish that inhabited the reef, that kept it, cleaned it, far beneath the notice of the Isharan Corallus who sculpted it. He saw the planktonic things they preyed upon, the larger fish that preyed on them, the squids and jellies that used the hard structures of the coral to lay their eggs. It was a constellation of connected lives, a maelstrom of movement and light, and Lurien was at its heart. His eyes were starting to adapt. That was not to say that he saw, too gripped by his own numb sense of horror and wonder to do aught but take the knocks as they came. The winding passages and occasional chambers were replete with obstacles, barnacle-tiled tables, curtains of stiffened kelp, manacles bolted to the coral by leaden chains. Anything not made of still-living material, or old enough to have been layered in ocean magic, remained invisible. He swam into cupboards and stools, bumped his head more than once on light globes that had long ago drained their soul charge and been abandoned by the Isharan that had set them.
"Must you swim into absolutely everything?" said Namariel,
a spectral presence by his shoulder.
"I could track the noise you were making from Elgaen."
She took his wounded hand in hers. He pulled it back with a yelp.
"Pull yourself together, Archelian.
The Namatai was a faint shimmer of soul vigour and magic, but was better perceived as an eclipsing body over the dim glow of the reef, her half-soul less virile even than the corals around her.
"You touch so freely," he murmured.
"Because my soul withers too quickly to be noticed by the Dark Prince of Excess. Now, focus, my prince. So far I have taken us by the more vigorous passages, where the coral is thick enough to cloak us from prying eyes. But we are almost clear now, and it is mostly dead reef from here. You will have to move quietly and still your thoughts. Can you do that?"
"What?"
"The guards will be behind us now, but they are Namatai, as I am. If you appear any different from the fish we swim amongst, they will see it as well as I can."
Can you do that?"
Lurien pushed the heel of his palm into his forehead and closed his eyes. The techniques of separating mind from body and self from mind were many and varied. Lurien had learned most of them, for Lagithe had been supremely gifted and singularly insistent, but seldom had he had the inclination to practice. He willed his thoughts to slow. The distances between them seemed to expand. the cold of the greater ocean entering into those spaces to chill their motions further still. One thought in isolation was nothing. Taken in isolation, even the most burning of worries could be picked up, turned over, examined to exhaustion without emotional risk. That was the key. It was only when thoughts combined in the crucible of an uncontrolled mind that they gained the power to insist and bedevil.
"Good," said Namariel. "Very good."
He felt her point into the spiralling arms of soul light and darkness.
"That way."
"Do you have a plan?"
"Get out of the dungeons, then get out of the enclave."
"And go where?"
"One stroke at a time, my love. Come now. There are people waiting."
"People?"
"One stroke at a time." She led.
He followed. Time stretched when one bid oneself to experience nothing. Lurien remained conscious of the kicking of his feet, but it was a metronomic act, one he witnessed rather than took any part in performing, a thing of singular boredom from which he would drift back and forth, no idea how long it had been or how long there was still to go. This was the state which purists, like Anir, sought to occupy, the state that awaited them all in the Corellium. Both promised an escape from the depredations of Slaanesh. Lurien had always found the promised sanctuary of the afterlife a dull prospect. Worse, it was hypocritical. What was total deprivation but an excess of its own, an overreaction to a species of fear that could be as easily negated with smaller measures and lesser sacrifices? "All things in moderation," that was what Lagithe would have said. But that had been before he had given a promise before the gods. Maybe. Now he watched himself, captivated by the meandering thought processes of a stranger engaged with the thinking of nothing. Twice removed, he sensed the passage his body was swimming through widen into a spherical chamber. He sensed open water, fresher salts, stronger currents. With unexpected reluctance, he began reeling back the more explorative parts of his consciousness.
"Holder!"
A male voice. Lurien felt movement towards him, but his thoughts were still too widespread to register either fear or surprise. A hand grabbed for him. It moved with staggering languidness, the slowdown of his thoughts dragging the world to near standstill. He felt the coarseness of skin, tasted the salts under the elf's fingernails, water rushing over knuckles like waves on rocks. The composite mind image tingled between his expanded senses like a picture in the sky. He plucked at his body's strings, his forearm batting the incoming grab aside, and then pushed back with his own hand, aiming for where his mind told him his assailant's mouth would be. His attacker caught the open palm and twisted. A bright spot burst across his mind. Not pain, exactly. Pain as it appeared to someone on the outside. Something that a soul capable of empathy would share a portion of and wince in sympathy. The assailant shoved him back into the wall of the chamber, elbow in his neck, knee in his groin, his back forced into the curve of the chamber's sphere. A low growl trembled from an elven throat.
"Release him, Moragai," said Namariel, "lest you break my betrothed."
At the Namatai's order, the various points of pressure on Lurien's body were grudgingly withdrawn. The dark water occupied by this Moragai offered no welcome or apology of its own beyond a surly grunt, but Lurien sensed the figure sculling backwards.
"These would be your friends, then?"
Lurien rubbed his throat and ruefully cupped a hand over his bruised groin. As he might have expected, and as Lagithe had always taught, the world was a darker place when senses and mind coexisted under the same skin. I can tell.
You went deep, said Namariel. She sounded genuinely impressed, and Lurien drew a moment's pride from that. I did not think you capable.
My mother was the Tide Mistress of Briamdar, an Isharan queen and the mightiest of her fane in the Green Gulch. I just don't like doing it. It makes me feel like a thorn jelly, or something like it, drifting on the ocean's currents.
It was impressive. I could barely see you myself, and I was swimming right behind you.
Lurien squinted ahead into the gloaming soul light to where he thought Moragai must be. The sphere of the chamber was illuminated by capillaries of dimly living things, against which he could almost convince himself Namariel was faintly defined. Even that impression was guided mostly by the sound of her voice and his growing, unwelcome familiarity with her grotesque half-soul. He saw no one else.
"Light as stone, Uriel," said Namariel. "Let our prince take a moment before we move on."
There was a napping of stone followed by a spark of light. Lurien winced as a muscular silhouette set a blazing glowstone on a shell-encrusted table. He grunted, blinking as the brilliance slowly leached back into the dark. Aside from the table on which the glowstone burned, sputtering off its soul light, the chamber was sparsely furnished. A scattering of empty shelves and alcoves that had been grown directly from the walls, a garderobe of some kind, overgrown by leafy algae, for the Archelian commander of a garrison that the dungeons had apparently never needed. Three blind and collared Namatai watched him. One was already beside him, possessively close. He had seen her once before, only then she had been in mourning garb and painted in maroon, dancing for the gods from within a crowd. Namariel. She was as beautiful as he recalled, and somehow even more so now for having her figure properly clothed. She was garbed in a long seaweed kirtle, suited to travelling, ribbed at intervals with fishbone, buttoned and weighted at the hem with rough zircons, so as not to interfere with her swimming. An ivory, white, whisperwood bow was strapped across her back, with a cloak draped over the opposite shoulder, its colours sufficiently bland as to have plausibly originated from any enclave in the gulch, assuming it were to attract notice at all. A colour sense, Lurien knew, was something all Namatai lacked. A shagreen bodice enclosed her upper body, crisscrossed with tight straps and bulging pouches, leaving her well-muscled arms bare. Of Namariel's companions, the male was the most immediately striking. He bulged with muscle, like an auroch wearing an elf's skin, which, given the infinitely variable manifestations of the soul transference ritual, he might well have been. His forearms were encased in heavy leather gauntlets, a crown of nails describing a Druhiri death rune had been hammered into his skull. Scars covered his body, but a second glance revealed them to be the result of burns rather than blades. Given his physique, Lurien assumed him to have been a smith of some kind, enthralled to one of the artificers of the Ishratizar. Useful to have around, given the Namatai's obvious physical power and the still-throbbing hurt in Lurian's throat and hip, this, clearly, was Moragai. The second of the two was the most delicate-looking girl-child that Lurien had ever laid eyes on. He could not even begin to imagine what duty so frail a thing could have been given to perform. She resembled a doll made of porcelain and black pearls, the sort that would sit above an Archelian's bed to remind him of the misery of the half-souled. A bald head winnowed away what little stature she had. Her Hadrilkar was an immense mass of lead around her slender neck, and it was only by the natural buoyancy of the water that she was able to lift it at all. her pale skin prickled with an intensity that reminded him of the one time he had witnessed a fully charged Fangmora preparing to bite. She regarded him in turn with an eyeless yet unsettlingly perceptive gaze, as though mentally peeling away his skin to look inside and finding nothing there. She said nothing.
"Your Hadrilkar bears the sigil of Lagithe's house," Lurien said. "As does yours," he turned to the burly smith. "Is that why you have chosen to help me?" "We can tell each other our stories later," said Namariel. "For now, we need to swim. Van Glyer will notice your absence eventually, and I want to be a long way from Briomdar when he does."
"And go where?" said Lurien. "Perhaps as Namartai you do not know, but there are no soul scryers in the mortal realms more gifted than those of the Briamdar Terskol. They could follow the soul of a fly through the garden of Nurgle, and their tide casters could send a phalanx there to retrieve it. I cannot hide from Vanglyer Felglave."
"Not forever, perhaps, but long enough."
"Especially if he can quiet his soul like that again," said the big elf, his voice like a mailed fist in the jaw.
"We should go to Elgaen," said Lurien. "Aunt Larame will protect me." "Too close," said Namariel, shaking her head. "Too obvious. And as your betrothed, may I say, too unambitious."
"Where, then?"
"Soon."
Namariel beckoned to the smaller of the two Namartai.
"Come, Morrigai, it is time to make our prince look the part."
The porcelain girl-child gave a contentious jerk of her head, lips peeling back as if the taking of instruction were somehow akin to a limpet tick alighting on the back of her skull.
"Wait,"
Lurien pointed at the dishevelled waif. "That is Morrigai."
"What do you think, Morrigai?" said Namaria. "Can you work with this?"
The elf girl drew a hooked, twin-bladed knife the length of Lurien's middle finger and grinned. The magical currents of the Gulch stream converged at their strongest over the deep ridges of Briomdar. 22 spires rose from the barren crust like a broken crystal, glimmering with ancient power. Each represented a fundamental truth, the wisdom and knowledge that Teclis had imparted on the Kaithai only to see his light fade from the minds of their descendants. The ghost glow of Ishratizar made entablature, gods and heroes of the Kaithai, legends of the Asur, 100 feet high, stood firm against the primordial flows, as unfixed in the eye as the lessons of Teclis were in the mind. The spires were a mandala of 3 rings, each dedicated to a circle of gods whose significance no Corallus could explain, but which every elf could intuit and see unconsciously manifesting in their craft. An outer ring of 14 surrounded by an inner ring of 7. These were the keeps and palaces of the Isharan and Archelian, the homes of the Terskol and the Azydrazor. At the centre, a watery spear of turquoise and gold rising from the omphalos of the mandala atop Tor Mathlan, greatest of gods, and the original wooden citadel of the Cranstock, was the Jade Palace. Lurien had never seen it from this distance before. It was beautiful. They had emerged from the dungeons under the mournful coronach of the Ring of 14. The song in the air was that of the life currents of Gairan, blasting through the mile-high reefs that formed the enclave. After that they had quickly hidden themselves in the sprawling marketplaces and craft shops of the lower city, and Lurien had become immediately and stupendously lost. For an isolationist species, the Idoneth still harboured a deep-seated instinct for trade, and this racial yearning they humoured largely amongst themselves. The ocean provided all. Live beasts from the gulch,
fish meat, products of bone, ink and pearl and ivory. And then there were the luxuries, exclusive to the noblest classes, bespoke coral artifacts and soul-imbued objects like glowstones, objects that only the time and skill of an Isharan could create. Namariel had already purchased a number of smaller items, which the hulking Ureel bore without complaint in a pair of panniers slung across his broad shoulders. At a butcher's stall she posed as the agent of an embaler caravan, sent to barter for a bushel of fish meal. Discussing medicaments with a Namatai child in a herbalist's stall, her story and demeanour changed again to make her the set-upon thrall of an Ishratizar perfumer, seeking only the finest sense-deadening potions to release her master's creative thoughts. Her skill at dissimulation was astounding, and given what he had seen of her, Lurien could not help but wonder if some manner of sorcery were involved. She cast off personalities and donned new ones as easily and as often as Eodrin would try new cloaks. A different fit for every occasion. Hold up a mirror, tilt the head, askance, an accent for every class of company. Approaching a seller of fine cloths, she flowed again into a new role, lady's maid to an Isharan noblewoman, blithely prattling with the merchant of how her mistress wished to impress the visiting nobles of Turach in order to acquire one of Embela Irime's famous gulchmares.
"She'd best be quick,"
said the merchant as he wrapped the three bolts of good fabric in white, pale blue and silver that she had purchased in seaweed fronds.
"Queen Anair means to leave soon."
"Before the joining?"
said Namariel, in a voice so far removed from the caustic hag of Lurien's recent acquaintance that he wondered if he had become lost in the crowds and attached himself to another group of Namatai.
"Preparing her train at the Toranath Tardgate, I heard,"
said the merchant, passing the wrapped goods to Ureel and pointing in the direction of the huntress's spire. Lurien squinted in that direction. An enclave of the Eideneth was a living and breathing creature, a semi-divine being of tremendous space and arch beauty, or so Lurien had always entertained, admiring the glow of its spires from the balconies of the Jade Palace, Corlip flute in hand. From beyond the Ring of Seven, those dark expanses betwixt the spires dreamed with a confusion of energy and colour, life in all its gyronite profusion. Namatai fishherds moved their livestock, blubbery lori, fine-scaled caleth, elephantine jaguar whales whose eggs were a delicacy at the tables of Archelian kings beyond the riptides of the Lathway and the Kaelgaeta, green-shelled terrapin. Lesser children of the mighty Leviadon drew broad-finned wains laden with goods and elves. Cowguai and fangmorers hunted the scavengers that prowled its sprawl. Wherever larger predators lurked, drawn to the scents and sounds of the enclave, like Voltaire to carrion, the semi-domesticated bond beasts went in packs, and only rarely did they find prey in scarce enough supply to turn on the tented shanties of the Namatai classes. By the standards of human cities, Briomdar was spacious and sterile. Not once since their emergence from the dungeons had another elf come near enough to jostle Lurien, but the sensory proximity of so many of his elven kin was more than enough for him.
"What's he gawping at?"
said the merchant.
"Oh, he's simple," said Namariel.
Lurien opened his mouth to protest. He felt Morrigai at his shoulder, and he shut it again.
"It happens," said the merchant. "Sometimes a soul doesn't take. No one knows why."
"My mother once told me that theirs were souls already claimed by the gods."
The merchant shrugged.
"Oh, everyone has their theory."
Lurien sneered at the half-souled elf as Namariel gave her thanks and then pulled him back into the crowd.
"Trying to act more like a Namatai,"
she hissed. "I could say the same of you," Lurian snapped back.
"Don't talk. Don't stare. Be small in your movements. Don't draw attention."
Lurian scratched at the disguise Morrigai had hastily fashioned for him, ripping his royal cerecloth and butchering good Hessian into something bearing the vague shape of an elf. It itched like a coat fashioned from deep mare tongue, nor did it do a tremendous job of mitigating his nakedness, being little more than an upturned sack with slits cut for his arms and neck. It barely extended as far as his thighs. His feet were bare. It might have stretched a little further had Morrigai not delightedly taken her knives to the hem to fashion a thin strip of cloth for him to wear over his eyes. The material was sufficiently coarse that it did not impair his vision too severely, but it did conceal his eyes from anyone who did not look too closely. And it was Idoneth they swam amongst. No one was going to look too closely. He pulled on the thick metal Hadrilcar bolted about his neck.
"Uncomfortable," Ureol grunted.
"You probably get used to it," Lurian said.
"You don't."
Lurian frowned, not wanting to press the matter with the enormous Namatai. "The clothes are drafty."
"Morrigai was once master dressmaker to the House of Lagithe," said Namariel. "Her skills were highly sought by the lords and ladies of her court."
"Not her finest work."
"I told her to make you look like the lowest order of thrall, not a prince."
"You all get to wear clothes."
"Think of it as working your way up from the bottom, my love."
Lurian scratched the eye mask and rubbed at his bald head. It stung where Namariel had, with little enough warning but plentiful satisfaction, ripped the periwig from his scalp. He brought his hand down, brushing it across his forehead.
"The namaste she drew on my face, it is not permanent, is it?"
Ureol chuckled sourly as Namariel led them slowly, almost casually, towards Tor Anath. Morrigai, he had come to realise, never spoke, or did so with such rarity as to make no difference. She trailed after them like a silent urchin, a semi-feral porcelain beast-child that nobody had ever loved enough to teach words.
"Why are you taking me through the Huntress's spire?"
he whispered, after Namariel had dropped a handful of shells bearing the sole imprint of Queen Lagithe into the hands of a cobbler in exchange for a pair of boots in Lurian's size.
"Because that is where Anair is. Or have you not been heeding the merchant's gossip? Churak, that is your plan. Anair despises me. The best I could hope for from the City of Spines is that the Asglirachelian will kill me before returning me to Vanglaer." "Think of it another way. If you can convince Queen Anair, then you can convince anyone. And you will want the second greatest army in the Gulch on your side. War is not my expertise, but I imagine that it will come in useful if you mean to dethrone the Felglaive."
Lurian snorted.
"There is the simple matter of opportunity as well," said Namariel. "Mabor and Galra here intend to remain in Briomdar for several tides yet, as the Felglaive's guests. There will be no chance of escaping with them before Vanglaer notices your absence. Escape is our most pressing need. We can refine what comes next when we are safely in Turak."
"I am the rightful king of Briomdar," Lurian muttered.
Lagithe, the great tide mistress of Briomdar, had chosen him to adopt into her house, and it was him she had raised as her son and heir. What right did Vanglaer or anyone else have to gainsay her? "I will show Anair that she backed the wrong Achillean."
"You will, with my help."
"You seem to know a great deal of the comings and goings of royalty."
"It is remarkable what you can hear when you listen."
"I thought you were a Naethic dancer."
"The dead of the Corileum speak most freely of all. They have nothing else to do."
She leant in close, and Lurian cringed from the water that her breath pushed against his earlobe. He wanted nothing other than to scrub the offended skin with a Troas healing stone until he could no longer feel it.
"My ears are at your disposal now. Did you know, for instance, that Van Glyre means to give his promise to Lagithe tonight?"
"Lagithe is dead."
"No Idoneth truly dies once they are interred. Take it from one who knows.
He means to join our houses, legitimize his rule. Fuethain."
"But why?"
"The Achillean Council have already given him the right. He has the backing of Galrahir and Anir. Can he really fear the disapproval of the other enclaves?"
"Let us hope so."
"Why did Van Glyre spare my life? Why not just let me die?"
"I don't know."
"Every noble in the Green Gulch was there at the assembly. He could not have wished for a more public spectacle of his rule."
"Does it matter?"
"It does if I say it does." Namariel patted his bicep, then lowered her head to rest against his shoulder. She said nothing more, and Lurian was forced to endure several excruciating minutes with her arm in arm before they came to a stallholder whose floating displays marked him as a seller of arms. Namariel approached directly, raising her voice to indicate her intention to buy. Racial inclination or no, the Idoneth were too deeply introverted to make effective hawkers. "Must we dally with every merchant between here and Tor Anath?"
"But, my love,"
she said, loud enough for the merchant to hear,
"we are to be wed, and you simply must have a weapon as fine as one of these if you are to protect our home, our children."
Her face took on a horrified expression.
"My father is too old to look out for us now. The unbinding withers him a little more with each tide."
The weaponsmith pressed his fingers to the namastir on his forehead, then turned his hands over, opening them like a bivalve shell, and bowed.
"May Mathlan intercede on your behalf and bless you with a child of full soul."
Namariel interlocked her fingers across her heart.
"Oh, you are kind."
"I have 14 children,"
the merchant said.
"We haven't given up hoping or praying."
14 souls bought with Achillean steel, Lurian muttered.
"What was that?"
said the merchant.
"My beloved speaks to himself sometimes,"
said Namariel.
"An eccentricity of the soul, but I do love him for it."
"A lucky man, then," said the merchant.
Lurian made a face that he was relatively confident the blind Namatai could not see.
"May his luck carry through to your children. But you are right, lady. There are many beasts, particularly here in the Low City. The Achillean seldom patrol beyond the Ring of Seven, which most here would think for the best, but there are plenty of Namatai prepared to prey on their own."
Lurian snorted. "What are they own worth stealing?" He glanced at Namariel and then looked at his feet. "I mean, we..."
"The robes on your back, the woman on your arm."
The merchant reached across and pushed a finger into Lurian's false namastir. He recoiled from the touch.
"The soul in your flesh would be worth more to the right elf than anything in my stock."
Namariel drew Lurian close, as though unsettled by such dark talk. Her fingernails dug into his arm until even cold, deadened elf flesh felt it and demanded a wince.
"I hear that even the Achillean will sooner trouble an unarmed Namatai than one with a blade."
The smith looked over his shoulder before nodding.
"True, true, though, as I say, it is the soul renders you need to be wary of."
Lurian's genuine look of horror was perfectly matched for Namariel's act.
"What is your favoured weapon?"
The merchant spread his hands over the display. For a slave whose business was to arm other slaves, it was a decent enough selection. The centrepiece of the display, on a felt rug draped over the shell of a bond clam, was a collection of swords of various grades. They had been neatly arranged in order of size, from keening knives on the left, all the way up to the lanmarai on the right. In buckets attached to the back of the bond clam by ropes and suspended by floating air sacs were byspears, axes, and whisper bows. They were useful enough weapons, but more suited to the skills of the Namatai classes. But Lurian's training at the Azydrazor had achieved nothing if not lent him an eye for a weapon. A Rumphia, an elegant Archelian pole arm, stood amongst the byspears. The graceful curve of a hellsaber framed the display of swords, half drawn from its sheath, so that Lurian might admire both the waving pattern of the golden blade and the craftsmanship of the scabbard. There was even a razor-shell harpoon hanging by a strap from one of the clamshell's ridges. Namariel slapped his hand from the harpoon and set it upon the blue zircon pommel of the hellsaber, laying her smaller hand atop his. Her body pressed into his back, and she gasped lightly as his fingers touched the grip. Lurian wanted nothing more than to shrink into his own bones and leave his dead skin to her touch.
"Yes," she said, "it must be this. The lady has a keen feel for quality."
The merchant picked the hellsaber from the rug and drew it fully from the sheath so that Namariel could admire its cutting edge. Lurian, he had apparently surmised, and correctly, was no longer relevant to this sale. He felt himself phase out as the pair settled over the minutiae of price. This part of the market was thick with the stench of burden beasts, the water alive with the lowing of fangmoras and giant teglai sea snails. The teglai were one of the few mortal species with the stamina to cross the vast tracts of ocean that separated the enclaves of the gulch. Their enormous shells were wrapped in cargo netting, Mbela-trained Namatai drovers sitting patiently on the apex, whispering softly to one another, reins loose in their fingers. In amongst those giant animals were shell-armoured carriages drawn by paired alopexes in breeching and traces, and caparisoned in silver. The predatory beasts sniffed and snarled at each other, irritated as much by the proximity of the placid teglai as the bow-armed Namatai that clambered over them. Other Namatai, with the look of serviles and thralls, checked over tack and blinds and the security of the stowage nets, while half a dozen Archelian knights watched their toings and froings disdainfully from the backs of their fangmoras. The knights wore long coats of silver mail, ice-blue and white surcoats, and conical helms decorated with silver fins. They were the Asglir, the elite warrior class of Turak, Anir's silvered helms. They had arrived, Lurian realized. The great spire, rising vast and softly blue above them, must have been Tor Anath, and he was looking at Anir's mission as it prepared to make its departure. Everything looked prepared. They could leave at any moment. The only reason they had not already done so was that there was no creature in the realms of mortals or chaos more disdainful of the concerns of others than the Isharan master of an enclave's tidegate. The tidecasters knew full well that without their magic, travel was so difficult as to be essentially impossible. And so even queens were forced to abide by their whims. Somehow, however, Lurian doubted the Queen of Spines would be made to wait over long. Essential they might have been, but someone like Anir could always find another tidecaster. The Isharan were generally adept at knowing how far they could push their value. Looking around, Lurian realized he could no longer see Morrogai and Uriel. They were probably already busy embedding themselves amongst the caravan's slaves in preparation. And he would say this much for Namariel. She had planned this well.
Namatai!
Lurian ignored the outraged shout, assuming it was intended for one of the hundreds of other Namatai in sight, and continued to search the caravan for his absent thralls.
Are you deaf, Namatai?
Lurin looked up to see a tall Archelian in a frock coat that had been cut artfully into strips to frolic with his passage through the water, and a wide-brimmed, frilled hat. The Archelian tugged it down at the front as he swam towards Lurien. The breath froze in Lurien's mouth.
Eodrain.
Lurien's unexpected ousting from court must have left his retainer suddenly without a patron. Cal O'Hare had at least some kind of military reputation to fall back on, while Vagos had never much cared for the indulgences of court. Now he thought about it, Lurien was not sure why they had even been friends. Eodrain, he realized, must have ventured across the Ring of 14 for perhaps the first time in his life, in the hopes of currying favour with Queen Anir, or, failing that, one of her knights. In another place and time, Lurien would have laughed. If there was one Idoneth less suited to a place in Turak's Spartan court than Lurien himself, it was the elf in the frock coat and frilled hat. Instead, he tried to think what a Namartai would do with an angry Archelian swimming towards him. Imagination failed him. Eodrain grabbed a handful of his smock coat before he could say or do anything. Lurien gasped in pain. He expected cries of outrage from the Namartai stallholders, but none were forthcoming. A lord swam amongst them, and he could do as he pleased.
"Your head, slave," said Eodrain. "It has been dyed recently. Turquoise and gold."
Lurien shook his head dumbly, but that only seemed to convince Eodrain to grip his rags tighter.
"It is faded, but I see it there still, even if these eyeless soul runts cannot. Those are royal colours. I would be within my rights to kill you now for having worn them."
Namariel turned away from the weaponsmith.
"Please, Lord, he..."
"Quiet, woman. There can be no explanation."
Namariel eased herself across Lurien.
"Some form of recompense, then.
No."
Eodrain pushed Namariel aside. He'd already been drinking, Lurien could tell. The Archelian had probably hit upon this scheme of inveigling himself into Anir's circle while overnighting in the Corlap Gardens. He was here to impress an Asclean knight. He drew his sword.
"Eodrain," Lurien hissed, "stop!"
The Archelian gasped, sword half raised.
"Is that?"
With his other hand, he pulled the eye blind from Lurien's face.
"Eidolon of Mathlan. Lurien?"
"Eodrain, I can explain."
"What is going on over there?"
One of the Turak Asclear had turned his mount towards the disturbance. Lurien silently cursed. There went their plan to sneak out of Briomdar unseen, like the breath from a drowning man's lungs. Not that he had thought too highly of Namariel's plan to begin with. He watched the tiny darting movements of Eodrain's glassy eyes as the elf's mind dealt with the unexpected presence of his oldest friend. Very slowly, the Archelian began to smile.
"No," said Lurien.
"It is Prince Lurien,"
Eodrain yelled.
"He has escaped. I have him."
He lashed his sword across Lurien's belly. It was a careless move, with little lead-in, and Lurien had ample time to throw himself clear of it. With a sound like a sack being ripped, the Archelian blade cut through his Hessian surcoats. He did not feel the shallow cut across his middle. His back bumped into the merchant's bond clam. It was hard and ribbed. Blades clattered as he groped back. The merchant yelled angrily, but Lurien was not in the mood to care, even if he had been in the habit of bothering himself with what the Namartai thought. Eodrain stabbed for the throat, one-handed. The other hand curled behind him as though to grasp a kerchief. Lurien seized the first weapon he got his fingers around and swung it up, smashing Eodrain's blade aside. Both Archelian looked at the unfamiliar weapon between them, with expressions of disdain and dismay. It was a Namartai estoc, longer than an Archelian sword, but shorter and lighter than a Lanmari. The straight blade was blunt, only the triangular point having an edge of note. Lurien imagined that the Namatai must have used it for bludgeoning armoured monsters, or mounted Archelian knights. Lurien gave a nervous laugh as he brought the estoc to guard, and Eodraine again lunged high for his throat. Lurien parried and replied, wielding the sword two-handed, and hacked diagonally across Eodraine's guard. For several rounds of block and return, the two Archelian flailed, as if aiming to embarrass the other with their lack of skill, and succeeding brilliantly. They were warriors raised by the Azaedrazor, but neither had ever slain another, nor shed blood in anger. The closest Lurien had come was his duel with Vanglire. A slim advantage, but one he meant to take. He parried one of Eodraine's swift lunges. The Archelian sword made a rasping sound as it slid down the estoc and sheared through one of the ropes that tethered the Namatai weaponsmith's stall to the float sacks. The bucket holding the merchant's by-spears began to sink, the float sack remaining afloat exactly where it had been, the severed end of the rope drawing lazy loops in the water. The Namatai gave another aggrieved shout, which Lurien would have happily continued to ignore, had a startle in Eodraine's eyes not convinced him to risk a backward look. The weaponsmith had unhooked the razor-shell harpoon from the bond clam and was aiming it at Lurien's back. The shoulder strap rippled loosely in the water.
"Why did you have to bring your trouble to my stall?"
He fired before Lurien could reply. The harpoon hissed towards the prince's shoulder blade. In the split second he had to spare, Lurien bent away from it, turning, but that was not what saved him. What saved him was that the harpoon was already missing anyway. Eodraine's mouth widened in silent realization, the Archelian experiencing something akin to a moment of awakening as his free hand closed around the metal shaft sticking out of his stomach. He was feeling pain for the first time in his life, and he was clearly quite certain that he did not like it. Lurien sympathized. The warrior screamed, eyes huge as though impaled on the claw of the Dark Prince. An arrow sprouted from the weaponsmith's neck before he could rue his error. Namariel knocked another arrow to her bow.
"I should have known that this much guile was beyond you."
"It was your plan,"
Lurien replied, "not mine.
All you had to do was be quiet and look unimportant, but no."
She pulled the bowstring taut as she turned towards Eodraine. Lurien kicked the base of the stave as she loosed, and the arrow hissed into the chest of a Namatai woman in a short leather dress sewn with pink and white shells. She might as well have been selected randomly for death, plucked from the crowds around Tor Anath by the spectre of Cain. The woman's arms flailed, the force of the arrow driving her into the net stall of a Namatai selling drinking shells. Namariel's expression blackened into anger.
"He is my retainer," Lurien said. "His life is mine."
A venomous hiss dragged his attention around. A heavily armoured Turak Asglia powered towards him on a silver caparisoned Fangmora. Their bodies crackled with a golden nimbus of voltaic charge. Seconds away, the Asglia lowered his volt spear.
"Namariel!"
The Namatai drew her bow around, arrow knocked. She was not going to be quick enough. With a dervish shriek, Moragai dived from the panicked crowds to slam into the Asclea's shoulder. The heavy knight barely seemed to register the girl's arrival until she drove a pocket knife up into his armpit. The warrior folded into her, but retained enough wit to reach for the arming sword in the saddle scabbard by his thigh. Silver shone. Then Moragai ripped the knife from elf flesh, hazing the water blue, and shanked what appeared to be a pair of dressmaking scissors under his helmet and through the bottom of his mouth. The knight issued a gurgling noise that, for all its restraint, made Eodraine's earliest screech seem positively rapturous. Moragai's lips parted as she stabbed him again, 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 with the pocket knife, holding the scissors firmly throughout. Lurien gulped as the Namatai girl mauled a knight of the most fearsome warrior order in the Green Gulch.
"Come on!"
shouted Namariel, loosing her arrow into the back of a Turak thrall. The Alopex, whose back he had been standing on, lunged for the nearest body, ripping through the armour of another Asclear and coming away with a leg.
"Before any more of them notice us."
Lurien looked around. The remaining Asklia were forming a ring around one of the shell-armoured carriages, presumably Anir's, the water hazed and shimmering with overlapping bubbles of biovoltaic shields. They did not seem to have noticed that one of their number was unaccounted for. Yet. Lurien did not expect that fortunate state of affairs to last for much longer, but he had a window, a small and ever-closing opportunity in which to get out with his skin intact. But how? One of the other tide gates, perhaps? Morrigai issued a death-rattle moan of elation as the Asklir in her grip finally fell slack over the horn of his saddle. The Fangmora twisted its serpentine neck around to bite her, throwing the girl clear into the water. Lurien made a grab for its pearl and silver inlaid harness and pulled hard. The Fangmora had more muscle crammed into that thick neck than Lurien had in his entire body. It pulled back, harder. He sailed towards its shovel mouth and thumped it on the snout with an open palm, just as the Azydrazor embalers had taught him. The blow dazed the sense organs in the eyeless creature's nose and mouth, turning it briefly placid in his grip. With a bitter laugh, he wound his wrist through the reins, tipped the still-installed Asklia knight from the saddle, and swung himself up into his place. He had himself seated just as the Fangmora recovered enough venom to twist its neck back and snap at him. Lurien slapped it across the jaw with the flat of his estoc and dug his bare heels into its flanks. A massive undulation of its 20-foot-long body almost pitched him from the saddle, but when that failed, it seemed to settle. Lurien brandished his clumsy blade, one hand on the reins.
"See how even the beasts know the true king of Briomdar."
"Celebrate when we are safely out of the enclave," said Namariel,
sliding the dead merchant's hellsaber into the makeshift sheath beneath her bodice straps and helping herself to one of his quivers.
"We will have to take our chances on another tide gate."
"Aurel!"
Lurien yelled over the commotion.
"Here!"
said the big Namartai.
"Put Eodrain over my Fangmora's neck."
The Namartai glanced first at Namariel.
"Do it," she said, "but swiftly. If we are quick, perhaps we can lose ourselves with the embalers travelling through Tor Estroith before word of this gets back to Vanglire, and the tide gates are barred."
"There's no way out, and you know it," said Lurien.
"I am not ready to go back to a life of chains just yet."
Hauling one-handed on the reins, Lurien dragged the truculent Fangmora towards the ocean that lay huge and emerald green beyond the tide gates.
"We will lose them in open water."
"Without burdened beasts or a tidecaster? There is no ether sea beyond the tide gates, Lurien. You would need to be insane."
"My no!"
Lurien kicked the beast forwards.
"Vanglire will have sent agents everywhere from Mordrakai to Rundar before he ever thinks to look for us out there."